time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host, Tommy Maldi. When we talked
all night. So let's talk about miracles. How you doing, man? I'm Johnny Gowdy, your host today at this podcast, How Did I Get Here? Let's talk about miracles. I wanted to go see Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. They played in Austin just this past Saturday. And I guess maybe a month ago, my friend Sandy was like, oh, you know, we might have an extra ticket. They're like $250 or some amount of money. That's a lot of money. I was just like, whoa, that's a lot of money to go to a show. So I just passed on it. And we took the night off so that people could go see it. And then we ended up, our gig canceled on Friday. And I bought a car a couple weeks ago, and I bought it outright. It was used, and I bought it off of Craigslist, and it wasn't a shady guy. But you never know, right? So I buy this car a couple weeks ago. I drive it for a couple of days, leave town, come back, drive it for a day or two, and then the radiator goes out. And this guy takes the car back to go get it fixed by his guy. And he's going to pay for it and everything, which is great. However, that left me on a weekend with no gigs, with no car. So I've got no gigs, and I can't go anywhere, you know, unless I call, hey, man, will you take me where you're going tonight, please? So I didn't really do that. I just kind of was like, well, let me just deal with my environment and see how I can hang with it. Well, I was getting really bored, and Saturday I walked up to the liquor store, and I bought a little bottle of booze, drank some of it, and kind of took a nap at around 4. I was kind of drunk, to be honest with you. I kind of passed out. And then my phone was ringing like at 7:30, like crazy, and it woke me up, and I thought it was Sunday already and everything, and it was just Saturday. You know those naps where you wake up and you're like, whoa, is it tomorrow? What did I do? What happened? What is anyone mad at me? Because usually when you're real drunk and you can't remember shit, someone's going to call you and go like, dude, I can't believe you fucking said that to them last night. And you're like, what did I say? So anyway, so it was my friend Samara. And so I look at my phone, and she called like 4 times. I'm like, what the F is going on? She's calling 4 times. I look at my text messages. There's a photograph that she sent me of an all-access backstage pass to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And she said, if you want this, call me back right now. So I called her. And I'm like half asleep, still drunk, like, oh my God, please, I want to go. She goes, cool, meet us at this restaurant. I'm like, yeah, that's cool, except for I have no car. Also, coincidentally, I have no money. So will you come get me and treat me to a night of fun and excitement? And of course, she was down. So she came and got me, and I went and met Davi Garza and Ian McLaughlin with my friend Samara, and we went to go see Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers backstage. And I got to say hey to Benmont, and Mike Campbell was back there, and all these dudes are back there. My phone's always going off. That's the Oprah song. It's like Today on Oprah. Anyway, so it ended up being an amazing night. I hung out with Ian McLaughlin. It just got inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's a keyboard player for the Faces. He's a great guy, a lot of fun. And then he and I went to Justine's and had a great time. So I ended up seeing this amazing concert from the side of the stage and saying hey to band guys and stuff that I wouldn't have normally gotten to see if I would have just stayed passed out at my house. So it was a miracle, a rock and roll miracle. So that was that. And I guess before we go any further, that was my weekend. It was great. So I saw Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. It was absolutely amazing. And I hope if you're out there, you get to see them on this tour, because they're doing great sets and always a great live band to see. And before we get to today's guest, let me do a quick commercial. That's the word, commercial. Here's a commercial. Today's episode of How Did I Get Here is brought to you by Hotel Vegas, 1500 East 6th Street. This week at Hotel Vegas, they have a very special week planned for you. Wednesday, May 9th, 8 p.m., a Neil Young Hoot Night with the Memphis Strange and a lot of other bands. Come there at 8, lots of bands playing Neil Young songs. Should be awesome, right? Like Neil Young. Thursday, May 10th, happy hour, no cover, doors at 5. Our good friend, Graham Wilkinson, he was on the podcast. He goes on at 6. And then Bugaboo goes on at 7:30. Remember, no cover, so that's a good jam. You can go there and have some cocktails. And then later on that night, Thursday, May 10th at 9 p.m., Hellfire Social and Zapata. Then Friday, May 11th, 9 p.m., In the Room series with What Made Milwaukee Famous. Now, What Made Milwaukee Famous, it's a $10 cover. It's a small, intimate show, and they're going to play two completely different sets. I talk about it a little bit with Michael Kincaid, who coincidentally is my guest today on the show. We talk about this a little bit, and, you know, Michael, it seems like it's going to be a good show. He seems excited about it. They're going to play some songs you might not have heard them play in a lot of years, and there'll be some DJ sets by The Shake in between. Then Saturday, May 12th, 9 p.m., the In the Room series at Hotel Vegas continues with Ume, and My Empty Phantom opens, plus DJ Mahelani. Ume is going to be playing. Doors are at 9, show's at 10. And, you know, look, this is what's going on at Hotel Vegas. It's going to be a good time, all right? Hotel Vegas, 1500 East 6th Street, Austin, Texas. Let's get down. All right, my guest today is Michael Kincaid from the band What Made Milwaukee Famous. You know what? I met Michael through a video of mine that he was in for the song called You Can't Pretend Forever. He's actually in my video. We never even talked about it during this interview. But they just finished recording a record. It's called You Can't Fall Off the Floor. And they just started a Kickstarter campaign to film a video for the first single, which is Gone and Done It Now. And I wanted him to come as Artemio Jones. If you watch their Kickstarter video, Artemio Jones is the host. And I think that's Michael Kincaid's Tony Clifton. Anyway, man, we talked about what he's about. Katy, Texas, America, you know. He's a great guy. I'll say this. Every time I'm around Michael, I want to hang out with him. So, like, when I run into him somewhere, I always end up talking to him for a while because I just like him. I do. That's a weird thing to say. I like him. We're not very close, but maybe someday we will be, and I'll tell him I love him. So I guess without further ado, from What Made Milwaukee Famous, here's my guest, Michael Kincaid.
I've had less than my fair share of lucky breaks and enough of this fooling around. I got one last chance to get rid of my past and bury it deep in the ground. And no matter what you try, man, you're never gonna tear me down. When the only blame you cast is your own, and your only guarantee is your fear of the unknown. If you don't cut your losses before you get lost, they're never gonna of advice, I'll repeat only twice. After that, you can fend for yourself. If you think that your shoes...
Michael, I think you're a fucking great songwriter.
Thanks, man.
But I'm really disappointed. I thought you were going to come today as Artemio Jones.
Oh.
I was worried. I thought I was going to get some Kaufman, what was the guy's name? Tony Clifton.
Yeah, Tony Clifton. No, yeah. They actually suggested that I go like on a date as one of the Kickstarter packages as Artemio Jones, but I think Renee might have been a little upset about that.
She might not be mad if it's me, because I would go on a date with Artemio Jones just to talk about it with my friends.
Well, maybe we can adjust the packages to reflect that.
My guest is Michael Kincaid from What Made Milwaukee Famous and a lot of other bands.
Yep, I might be playing bass with another one here starting soon.
So, really?
Yeah.
And
doesn't
you guys
have a name yet, though.
No name.
No name.
So you guys have a new record out. You Can't Fall Off the Floor.
It's not out yet, but...
Sorry. You've got a record kind of almost in the can, going to come out this summer.
Right.
That's what I meant.
We're hoping for a July release. We finished it up. I've been working on it, like, started as a solo project, went to Milwaukee, went back to a solo project, went back to Milwaukee, and that's the way it ended up. We've got it all mixed and everything, not mastered, but mixed.
Right.
And we're planning on... We just started a Kickstarter fund to... help do the video for it.
It's always me that does that. It's never the guest. It's always me.
Was that a soap opera thing? Or?
Yeah, that's my I Just Got Molested theme from Oprah.
Yeah, so we're trying to film a video on our Kickstarter campaign to help promote the album and get it out sometime this summer. So.
Well, it's a great... I like that you took a piss with your video, because I get offended and angry at the... I'm an earnest artist, and I'm just trying to put my album out.
Right.
It always seems like you have no imagination.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
I saw some of the other video packages or video clips and stuff that people put together, and actually kind of felt like a jerk off, because I just didn't seem like I was taking it very seriously.
Yeah, but to me, it kind of almost is so much better.
Right. You just got to get people's attention.
Because it's an odd phenomenon. I mean, Do you think it's odd? I mean, when you first saw Kickstarter, were you taken aback a little bit? Like, this is where we're at? This is where we're at?
Right, yeah. And there's a bunch of other websites now that do that kind of stuff, too. It's basically, back in the 1600s and stuff like that,
of course.
They had people who, devoted money towards artists, and that's the only reason they were able to do that. And it's kind of back to that now, especially with... with what happened with Napster and the digital downloads and everything like that, it's you don't make money off albums and you rarely make money off touring with gas prices and all. So
yeah,
it's definitely something that's a necessity now.
Are you guys planning a tour for the summer when the record comes out?
Yeah, hopefully. I'd like to start planning a tour right now, but we're just trying to get back to playing shows around here regionally, because most of people, they all think we broke up anyway.
Right. Well, you had such a high profile and then just kind of mellowed out for a while.
Yeah, it kind of...
What was that? Was it just like you guys were on Barsook and mm-hmm. then you put out... You put out a record first on your own?
We put it out in 2004. We self-released one, and then
they re-released it.
Then they re-released it, and we went back in the studio. We took like 3 songs off, and went in the studio with Jim Eno and recorded 4 other ones, and put that on the Barsook release. And then that came out in like 2005 or 6 or something like that. And then the last one came out in 2008.
Who produced that one?
That was Chris Michaels. He played with Sparkle Horse. He lives around here in town.
Yeah. I know that guy. He ran sound at the Mohawks.
Yeah.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. guy's really good sound man, too.
Yeah,
he's great. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so this new record you did with a dude that I met with you one night, I think.
Yeah, Danny Reich.
Danny, yeah.
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 He's the drummer of the Lemurs. I'm in that band as well.
Okay.
And he's such a talented engineer. It's kind of ridiculous. I think he's the most talented engineer in town. And he did Shearwater's last record, which is amazing. And he did like Bright Light Social Hour and White Denim.
Yeah, that White Denim record is really good too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where are you from? Are you from Houston?
I grew up in Katy. I was born in Jersey.
You were?
But escaped.
How old were you when you moved from Jersey to Katy?
Like 7 months.
Okay.
But I grew up there in Katy, outside of Houston, until I was 18. I went to school at UT, and apparently you have to go to class. So they kicked me out or just told me to go home and
What was your major? What was your
Well, it started off as psychology. It went to economics. Ugh, that was awful. And then I was there the last 2 semesters. I was in radio, television, film, but you have to go to those classes too. and so I went home to live with moms for a summer, sort my stuff out, and eventually ended up at Belmont in Nashville, and got a music business degree.
So you finished.
Right.
Were you playing music throughout that whole time?
Yeah, kind of. Like when I was in Austin, for some reason I didn't write a single song from when I graduated high school to when I went to Nashville. I wrote a bunch of like parts. I was trying to become a better guitar player, and then realized that it was just a futile effort. So just a bunch of pumpkin sounding stuff.
Yeah.
Then went up to Nashville and wrote Sweet Lady. That was on the re-release on Barsook. I think that was one of the first ones I wrote up there. And we had, my minor was music production and stuff, so we had access to pretty good studios.
Yeah.
And I got to record 3 or 4 songs up there on that. So
that's cool. Did you play out in Nashville, or did you become part of the scene, or were you just a college guy?
I didn't really. I played 1 solo show, I think, up in Nashville, and which was really scary. I mean, solo shows are still scary for me, but
are they?
Yeah. I mean, it's just strange because I don't play guitar that well. It's just like, and any place there would be a solo, it's just kind of editing the song on the fly. Plus, I never practice or anything like that, so it's just, I don't know.
Like a man after my own heart.
Ill-prepared.
No jazz.
Yeah.
Can't read music.
Right. Well, I could read music because I was in choir. I was a choir boy for X amount of years.
So when, what kind of life path were you on when you moved out to Nashville? Like, were you like, I'm going to be a producer, or I'm going to be a...
I was going to be a partier, just pretty much, yeah.
That's cool.
Well, I was hoping, you know, it was that cavalier attitude of, you know, 18 and 19, where you think it's just going to fall into your lap.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can live the lifestyle, and it's just somehow just going
right.
to land in your lap. And you don't have to do anything for it. But when I got up there in Nashville, it all kind of... It put things into perspective, you know, when you're learning about publishing and copyright law and all that stuff, and even production, just being in the studio. Yeah, I love recording. So that instilled that, you know, love of that.
Do you produce other bands? You do. Didn't you produce Mike and the Moon Pies?
Well, I've been working with them. We've been kind of stuck in pre-production. It might turn out to be Mike's solo album.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I've done some work with, it's mostly like demo kind of stuff, just because I don't have access to a studio very regularly. But I co-produce this stuff with Danny. But he's like a great sounding board for that kind of stuff. Some of the songs were actually, I was thinking of doing like a Bob Dylan thing, just the acoustic guitar and vocals, and the places he took it, like, were... I mean, it makes the song so much better.
Is that how you guys did this record? Like, you started off with you and then built the songs around, like, a performance or something? I produced a record like that for someone once.
There were some of them that I had already fleshed out, and the demos pretty much sound a lot like just shittier versions of the of what, you know, is on the album. But there were some that, you know, there were at least two or three that I just didn't really know exactly what to do with it. And I was just going to make it very, minimal and everything. And the stuff that Danny, you know, suggested and put in there just, you know, makes it exactly what it is now. And is, which is 10 times better than what it was going to be. So
wait, going back, like, what was the thing where you were like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Like, I'll do this. Like, what was the... Usually there's like an event or a concert, or you get a blowjob after a show and you're like, okay, I'm here. This is what I'll do. If you're, you know, young enough to appreciate something like that.
Well, I mean, it was definitely like, I've always wanted to do music. It's been, you know, it's a pipe dream in general, but it was baseball or music for me, and I was a B-teamer.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad I didn't choose baseball. You know, I won my first talent show when I was like 4, doing "You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog."
On an instrument, or you're just singing, just like shaking your ass.
It's hilarious. The picture I have is me holding like a Mickey Mouse guitar backwards. So maybe that's why I suck so bad at guitar, is I'm actually left-handed.
Okay.
I don't know, but it was just me, you know, caterwauling like a 4-year-old, but I was singing in the car and everything, and my parents could tell, and
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a half brother who's almost 50. It's weird.
Wow.
he's like, I was graduating from preschool when he was graduating from
high school.
High school, yeah.
Wow.
So, but he lives in Louisiana. We didn't grow up together all that much. But
you guys close at all? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's That's
cool.
He used to be a cotton farmer in Louisiana, so.
Wow.
There's Louisiana's a different place.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah, my brother's awesome. Yeah. Bobby Dale Kelly.
Awesome.
His name is Bobby.
Are your parents still together?
No. They got divorced probably when I was right when I was getting out of high school. So.
Okay. Was that weird? Was that the form of shit? Like, did you get away because you're like, I don't want to be around this shit?
Yeah. Well, I was. People. I was. You know, about ready to go off to college anyway, but it was kind of strange. Just, I felt so naive because I didn't see it coming at all, but apparently, you know, it was coming for a while.
Right.
It was a difficult time to find that out. You know, like, a lot of people get their parents get divorced when they're like 6 or 8, and it's probably difficult for a while, and then it just becomes kind of normal.
Right.
But at that point in time, it was like,
you kind of have a life.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was strange. But, you know, my mom's remarried up in Louisiana, and my dad lives out in Richmond, so Richmond, Texas.
Yeah, keeping it real out there.
Yeah.
Isn't Jerry Cantrell is from KD too, isn't he?
Is he? I don't know. Yeah.
I think his dad still lives out there, the Rooster.
Really?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
I need to check that out.
I met that dude once, and he literally wears a belt that says Rooster on the back and has a huge rooster on the front. Nice. He's very into it.
Awesome.
He's the Rooster.
I know that Patrick Swayze lived out there for a while. Roger Clemens lived out there. Janine Garofalo went to my high school.
Yeah.
Renee Zellweger went to my rival high school.
I knew Janine when she lived in Houston. She said she's from Jersey and Houston, too.
Is she? Uh-huh. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, she went to my, I guess she was there maybe 3 or 4 years before me, but yeah, she went to my high school.
Yeah. Wow. She's older than you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think she's 40-something. Yeah. Yeah.
You're not, how old are you?
I'm 21.
Yeah. You look it. You really do.
36.
Wow. See? So you decided early on that you were going to do this. What was your first band?
Oh, man, I can't say the name of it.
Oh, come on. That's my favorite part of this whole podcast.
It's the worst name in the history of time.
No, it's not. There's no way. I've had people with the worst names you've ever heard.
You name two or three, and I'll let you know if they're the
John
worst.
Sanchez was in a band called Chaos Horde. That was like totally metal with like...
It's all right.
Death.
It's kind of like Dead Horse.
Four Horsemen. Yeah, it is like Dead Horse.
Well, Dead Horse is better. That's a pretty good name.
Yeah, Dead Horse is a really good name. Okay, sorry. So this nameless band, what kind of music were you playing then? Like, what were you into?
I'll give you the initials. It was MG. How about that?
It's good.
And it sounds something like Global Village-ish. But Global isn't in the name. It's that bad.
I love that you can reference Global Village. You mean right. The band from Houston?
Right.
Shit, man. I was in the scene with those guys. Yeah. That guy Les and me went to college together. Black dude that played guitar
really?
From Canada. Awesome. Talks like the whitest dude you've ever met. It's very surreal. Oh, yeah. Hey, man. You guys are really getting funky over here.
Right. I mean, and you go back to Houston a lot. It's getting better now. But
I was in that funk scene in Houston, like 89 and 90.
Yeah, I went back to Jason Davis plays in 30 Foot Fall as well now.
Yeah.
And we went back. I guess they play a Christmas show every year at Fitzgerald's. And we went back and I saw, it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and they were playing that Christmas show. And the bands that were playing with them, it just sounded like 1992 all over again. It was, it's that slap bass new
I
metal.
I don't miss
stuff.
It at all. I really don't. So,
but yeah, I was in that band. We started that when I was like 16.
What kind of music was it? Was it funk?
Were you influenced by that
Houston funk sound?
We were just surrounded by it, so we kind of had to fit in with it. But, we did have some slap bass lines, but, it was still kind of all over the map. I mean, I could trace that back to even that first tape that we have, which I still have. I'll show it to you sometime. Oh, nice. We're not on the air.
Yeah, you can
see the band name.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's all hand-drawn stuff by me on the cover and lyrics, like, scrawled on the Xerox copy of the tape cover. It was still kind of all over the place. I mean, the first song I ever wrote, it's called Going Back, and it kind of sounds... It's obviously super cheesy because I'm 16, but it still kind of sounds like something like maybe like Almost Always Never, or one of the folkier kind of songs that's on a Milwaukee record. But there were still other ones, like we had a song called Living that was still pretty awful, and the lyrics were awful too. But it sounded kind of new wavy, and I didn't even really subscribe to the whole new wave thing there. I've always been kind of like, you know, I just like what I like. I take it all in from...
Right.
You know.
Well, growing up there, like, all the radio and stuff was very, like, at that, before I moved from there, was so, like, New Order, Erasure, Depeche Mode, like, far more than here.
Yeah.
Or, you know, other towns. Houston was very, like, new wave.
Right. And especially in a sense of, like, kind of whole the white boy dancing culture of junior high and high school like that. You'd go to... The Fame City Water, or Fame City had that one dance club there, and I think Astroworld had one too. And that's before it was, you know, baseball, or well, around the time it was baseball or rock and roll. It was also, I just wanted to be a living color dancer, you know.
Right. Yeah. There was a place there in Houston that I would go to called Energy. Do you remember that place? It was on Shepherd.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Cabin in the Heights, I don't know. Anyway, you guys played at Fitzgerald's with that band?
Yeah,
the young band?
We started at Zelda's when they had the ties stapled to the roof and stuff like that, and then worked our way up. I think our first show at Fitz was maybe with the Gingerbread Men or something like that, we played up there. And once Jason, our second drummer, in every one of my bands, it's just tons of drummers.
I think that's just normal.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. We had the first drummer, a drug dealer at our high school.
depending on what kind of band it was, it probably was pretty convenient.
Yeah. Well, we were still pretty,
straight laced kids.
Yeah. For a while there, at least. And then we got a kid that was in junior high. He was in eighth grade. We were all like sophomores, but he was a really good eighth grade drummer, and he played drums with us for a while. And then we got a drummer that was a year older than us. And then when he went off to college, we found this guy named JD that I think he still lives out in Conroe, actually. But I just happened on him at a club. I think it was Catal High Yuk or whatever that club was in Houston.
Okay.
Just happened on him one night. And he's a really great drummer. He knew Jason Davis, and Jason Davis joins the group around like 93, 94, and we changed the name, and I'll tell you that name. Name was Pollenhead.
That's a good name.
It's all right.
Did you guys have bad allergies or something?
No, I was, it was the last day of high school, and my friend and I were smoking something in the backyard, and his dog had pollen on its head, and walked up and was like, hey,
there it was,
new band name. And
dude, yeah, I got our name.
I called everybody instantly to let them know,
which had pollen on his head, that's our name.
Everybody was trying to escape the one we already had. That kind of
General Motors, that's all I can think of.
Motor General.
Motor General, sorry.
Then I went off to college. And tried to become Billy Corgan, I didn't have a band even up in Nashville at all, really. I jammed with a few of my friends and stuff like that, but when I got back here after I graduated Nashville, I kind of wanted to escape that town too. I like it, and I miss it sometimes, but it was still kind of a stuffy corporate thing, and I think it probably still is now.
It's weird because to me there's like two of them. There's like a real cool,
The pocket that's
there's like this real cool like rock and roll Nashville, and then the rest of it is like shitty.
Yeah.
Not, and I don't mean that bad, but it's just really corporate.
Yeah.
Really like the, it's man.
Paint by numbers music.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, it's and especially like right when I moved up there, they got the hockey team and the Titans and everything so there's, you know, tons of that. And not that that's bad, but it's just like it brings this other kind of money into town that was already working its way towards that corporate side of things anyway. So it kind of sucked the soul. When they're trying to tear down Hank Williams, the studio that Hank Williams like recorded stuff in, you know, to make some like a gift shop or something like that, then it's gone too far, I think, you know.
Yeah.
But I left there and came back to Austin and started a band called Another Bad One. Not a bad band. I think we were decent, but
bad name.
Dollar Gin.
Dollar Gin?
Dollar Gin, but not like the drink, like general abbreviated.
Oh, Dollar Gin. Oh, because like the store?
Yeah.
That's cool.
So I had that for a couple of years, and our guitar player got tendonitis in both hands, and our bass player moved to Indonesia, so... It's time to...
He got tendonitis. He must have been young.
He was, he was probably like 23, 4, something like that.
That's kind of early to have that kind of weird shit happen.
He was I think he was a programmer too, so, you know, so all that typing and
guitar it sucks. So then nothing really happened with Dollar Gen?
Yeah, we had a couple EPs, and we played Momo's a ton back then, and probably some Flamingo Cantina shows and stuff like that, and never really got off the ground.
Is that early 2000s?
It's probably
90s.
It ended in maybe 2001, 2002.
Okay.
Probably the beginning of 2002 is when it like fully dissolved. And I think the last song that I wrote for Dollar Gen that we never played was the first song I wrote for Milwaukee, which is trying to never catch up the self or the title for
right.
the first album. And I had written that and a couple other things and placed an ad, a series of ads in the Chronicle to find new band members.
My other favorite part of the story.
Yeah.
How did that go?
Well,
the most awkward situations.
Is,
like
I mean,
that.
it was kind of awkward too. Like the growing pains that came along with being in a band with guys that you don't know at
yeah,
all.
Yeah. You just call out of a paper.
Right.
Yeah.
And, that was strange. I mean, it was, I can't even really totally remember the screening process that we went through. I know we had a rehearsal space up at Brown Ferguson. It's up there. I can't remember what it was called, but it was a ton of rehearsal spaces up near like 290, 183 area off of Cameron.
Yeah.
Or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I went there one time to see some band rehearse.
Yeah, we had a space up there, and you know, I think Drew was maybe the first or second keyboard player that I met, and then John was maybe the second or third bass player I met, and then I think we went through quite a few drummers too. But yeah, and then found Josh, and then we just, you know, we all came from different musical backgrounds. John's totally like the DIY punk kind of, you know, Fugazi and all that stuff. And Drew is definitely like garage pop kind of stuff, and Josh was very world music ish. But he still, you know, they all had appreciation for other types of music.
Right.
And when we got in there and started playing, I mean, it was just kind of throwing stuff and you know, crazy wall walkers, like actually sticking to the
right.
wall. And
so you didn't come in with like a definite direction of what you were trying to do.
Not necessarily.
You had your songs and...
I mean, like in the ads, I posted specific artists and...
Right.
And even in the drummers, like even more specifically, just drummers that I liked and stuff like that. So, right. There were parameters set with that, but, you know...
No splash cymbals.
Right.
No double kick.
What's the little tiny little twing? Is that a China crash? What is that?
No, there's little splash cymbals.
Oh, splash. That's what it is.
And okay. People would do fills on them, remember?
Oh, yeah. Especially in Houston.
Yeah. No cage. No cage for your drums.
Not yet.
These are the things. No, these are the things that you had, like things you specifically didn't want the drummer to have.
Oh,
one kick drum, no splash cymbals.
And, self-control, but I mean yeah. That's drummers just overlook that one all the time.
No. Yeah. So there was something I hate it when this happens to me. I'm gonna stop smoking that stuff in the backyard when I'm looking for pollen in dog's hair or in dog hairs. So how long did it take you guys kind of to get it together?
I don't think
a few months or you
well,
started playing gigs.
We didn't play a show probably for the first 6 to 8 months. I mean, we really just buckled down and learned all the songs. And I think that was definitely one of the things we did right, you know,
yeah.
That when we finally played out, we knew those songs like the back of our hand and that definitely shows. It's definitely,
right.
It's hard to, I mean, with the Motts and everything, my cover band, we never practice.
Right.
And it doesn't necessarily show just because we all know the songs from listening to them on the radio and
right,
stuff like
right.
that. But when it's songs that you want to present that are originals, then you have to really know the ins and outs of them and everything. And so we didn't play any shows for like maybe 6 to 8 months and then started playing. I think one of our first shows was maybe Stubbs Inside. No, I think we worked our way up to Stubbs Inside. Our first show was at Flamingo Cantina.
All right.
And, you know, we played some of the smaller places around town, but definitely had some goals of trying to work our way up to playing the bigger venues and stuff. And it kind of, we recorded, I had like a BR8, like the little digital 8-track. I think it's a Boss digital 8-track.
Yeah.
And we recorded all our demos on that. And I think we sent out a demo that maybe had seven songs on it. No, our demos had four, but we did record like seven or eight with those and just kind of circulated them around. And it kind of, it just took off pretty fast, really. And we started getting really good shows. And I think around, we released our we self-released our first album at the Parish, I think, in June of 2004.
Oh, wow.
And that went really well. And then shortly after that, we started talking to C3, and they were talking about managing us. George Corey worked there. I think he's working with, who's the blonde-haired country guy? That guy. Jack Ingram.
Oh, yeah.
And
from the Woodlands.
Yeah. And he, you know, they started representing us, and we were doing, you know, the first, you know, after we started playing shows, I think we started touring shortly, maybe like six months after that or something. And they were all the book it yourself tours and stuff. When we pressed that first CD, I think we maybe pressed 2,000 copies and sent out 1,000.
Yeah.
Like to like periodicals and management companies, booking companies, labels, and all that stuff. And didn't really get any bites, but we did get a lot of press, though. I mean,
yeah,
like for blogs and online magazines and stuff. And so we started booking our own tours, which was somehow kind of easier. Well, I guess it was obviously easier back then. The gas wasn't nearly as awful. It was probably maybe...
No, but it was getting there.
Yeah.
It was getting hard, I remember, at that point. It was,
yeah,
it was getting like... I remember thinking like, wow, I could either just go do this by myself and just, it's not going to be like a full rock and roll thing, or like,
right,
you know what I mean?
Or just with a compact car, at
yeah,
least,
exactly,
you know, like,
yeah,
instead of a
van.
15 passenger van.
Yeah, with a trailer.
With a trailer,
yeah.
Right. But yeah, we started touring, and then C3 started to work with us towards the end of maybe 2004.
Or did you, like, when you're in a situation like that, and you guys had your own thing going on, you kind of had the handle on everything, and then you kind of hand it to somebody else that has more connections and all that kind of stuff, did you feel like, okay, like, did they kind of pick up and go somewhere with stuff?
Yeah,
with your project.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, like, in a good way, and they weren't like meddlesome or trying to change what we were doing or anything like that. And it was definitely helpful for me because I was still working like a 40-hour, you know, day job. I worked at this place for like 10 years. I started in sales there, which is just hilarious. I can't sell anybody shit. Then they realized.
I can't either. No, that like feeling of like, I couldn't do that.
It's like if I wouldn't buy it, then I'd be like, fuck it.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. You know.
Right.
So they moved me over to shipping and receiving, and I did that for.
It's just like a straight up job.
Yeah, totally. 8 to 5, and I did that for a long time, and then we finally got to a point where I needed to go tour, and I went in there and tried to quit. And they were like, nah, well, don't quit. Just go out on tour. We'll let you.
That's good.
And so they'd let me go out on tour. And I literally probably took, you know, out of 3 or 4 years that I was doing that, I probably took maybe like a total of 6, 7, 8 months off. Like when I'm only supposed to get like 2 weeks vacation. So I always felt pretty guilty about that. But so I would just go out on tour. And then when I got back in, I would just come back to work. And then it got, you know, around 2007, 2006, and 2008, we were out on the road like 8 months out of 2008.
Right.
And
what was your, is there some sort of association with Friday Night Lights? Did you guys have a song in it or something?
No, I wish.
Wow.
I think maybe Jenna, our old manager, worked with people that worked on Friday Night Lights.
Okay, I don't know why I have this in my... I've always had it in my head about you.
I watch it.
Since then. Okay, maybe that's what it is. I just want to know what you watch.
It's probably... I haven't seen this last season, but I watched everything up to then.
So when did you guys... You guys did... you guys started doing festivals, like when you did like Bonnaroo and the Austin City Limits Festival and Lollapalooza. Was that like... before the Barsuk or after Barsuk?
Barsuk picked us up in the end of 2005.
And so you did the Austin City Limits taping before then?
We did the Austin City Limits taping, I think.
How did that? I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing to be an unsigned band on Austin City Limits.
Yeah, we were doing those DIY tours and stuff, and we were out. I remember we just started working. You know, you just asked, like, did it change things a lot? We were out on one of those tours, and they called us. We had to cancel like two or three dates on this tour, and it was probably towards the end of it, I think. They called us and said we needed to come home early because we got on the sold out Arcade Fire and Black Keys show at Stubbs, and we were opening that.
Wow.
So, and you know, the biggest place we had played up to then is the Parish, and so we had to come home early for that, and then I think we had to cancel another date the next day. In the morning, they called and said that we were going to be on an Austin City Limits taping with Franz Ferdinand because Arcade Fire canceled their showing, which is just ridiculous. That, you know, I guess Drew had given a CD to Terry Lacona at a Thundercloud or something one time when he saw him, and he liked it, and so I guess that was kind of an entrance into it all. But then, I guess they kind of talked that up and we got on that. And then the next day they said that there was the Nine Black Alps or something like that. They had canceled their ACL festival.
And then you got on that.
So we got on that. So it was just like, we cut our tour short, like rushed home and got like horns and everything ready to do Building a Boat. And some of the songs that had horns on and everything. And we're, you know, that weekend was Arcade Fire with Black Keys on Friday. The taping actually, I think it was like Saturday and Sunday or something like that. The taping was the same day, I think, as the day that we played the festival.
Wow.
Like we went over to the KLRU studios to do sound check. They bussed us over to the festival, played the festival, bussed us back to KLRU to play that show.
Did you think at that point, like, oh dude, the floodgates have opened, this is it?
Right. Yeah. I couldn't even think, really.
It's huge.
It went from, you know, this level here to just like, wow, this is, I mean, it's
totally right. It's unforeseen. Like, it's like the biggest shit you can do nationally without leaving here.
Right.
Physically. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean,
it's amazing.
It went, you know, from there too, that we had some really great things happen just from, I guess, the exposure of that as well. We were like the first unsigned band, I think, on Austin City Limits taping. And then we started to play the festivals, which I really enjoy. And there's so many festivals. I was just up in Dallas this weekend, and we're playing up there in June. And I've been, you know, kind of looking at the local rags to see festivals and stuff around town, because at this point in time, maybe that's even better than touring, because they have a little more money to spend on artists and you're automatically in front of an audience. You don't have to put up posters or
beg people to come out of your,
They're already going to be there. So they have so many festivals like these days, even probably like three or four per town almost.
You're playing in Houston on June 2nd for the Free Press Summer Fest.
Yeah.
Free Press Summer Fest. That looks like it's going to be big.
Yeah.
Snoop Dogg is playing it. And
Willie Nelson. Avett Brothers, Flaming Lips.
It's a bunch of weed smoking dudes.
Yeah. We played the first one, I think it was in 2009, with like Of Montreal and Broken Social Scene, I think. And that festival is just every single year, it's gotten so much bigger. Last year, Weezer played and Big Boy or something like that.
Where do they hold it? Like in downtown in the Bayou?
Eleanor Tinsley Park, which is like right on Allen Parkway.
Yeah. Where you play like in the international festival times.
Yeah. Yeah. I think. I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, it's pretty big. And I mean, it's gotten huge this year. I mean, and our friend Juggy put that all together, and it's crazy to watch, because I'm really happy, considering, you know, Houston's music scene, that they finally have something like that.
Yeah.
That they can hold on to and everything. Yeah. and bring great stuff into town.
Yeah, so it's weird. I had a guy on here that's now the president of the Texas chapter of the Recording Academy. Was a guy that was in that music scene there, And we were kind of reminiscing during our podcast about all the bands. And I always think, like, every band, there's never been a band from Houston. I always forget about ZZ and King's X.
Yeah.
And the rap stuff.
King's X is from Katy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are from Katy.
Yeah.
So you guys went on, you got, when did you get signed to Barsook? After, like, shortly after that? Was there just, like, you were kind of on a wave of positivity?
It was probably, it was literally maybe like three or four months after the, maybe not even that long after the ACL taping of that week, the weekend of
right.
The storm.
Yeah.
And then we signed to them. We went back in the studio, recorded those four songs with Jim, you know, the drummer Spoon. And
how's he to work with?
He's awesome.
He does a lot of stuff, and he's got that beautiful studio. Did he have it then?
Yeah, it's great. We've actually recorded some of the new Lemur stuff too in that studio, and I hadn't been in there since I guess 2005 or six. So and he's got a bunch of great gear in there, and it sounds amazing. Drums sound amazing in that room. It's like it's not a big room, but it's a medium sized room. But it's, yeah, he's got like the catwalk upstairs. You put a mic up there, and one of the songs on this new album, Just Run, we recorded the drums there, and it sounds like Steve Albini kind of stuff, like Nirvana.
That's awesome.
Like In Utero.
Yeah.
But yeah, we recorded those four songs there, and Jim's totally patient, awesome to work with. We got those four, put those on the album, changed the color of the record.
Right.
And re-released that. And then some of those tours on that first...
Yeah, how did you do those tours when you were touring before the magical weekend? Were you doing those tours on your own and kind of like teaming up with bands in towns or doing show trades, or like how did you? You're just on your own out there doing it.
It wasn't even much show trading going on. I mean, occasionally we'd go to a city where we knew some people and you know, where we could. I think maybe Nashville, we knew friends of friends that played the show with us, but a lot of it was just, I was booking it, and it was kind of ridiculousness. So I remember one of the shows in Des Moines, we played Ska-Loween, and it was four ska bands and us in the middle.
Wow.
And there was a White Castle eating contest where you had to wash it down with a gallon of milk. Right on stage, right before we got on there, and somebody yarped before we got on stage. And I know we played when we played in Milwaukee. It was a Rockabilly Bill, and just us on the middle of a Rockabilly Bill. And it was more about like we're gonna be in this town here. We need a show.
Right,
scramble to find
Take
a place
whatever.
To play.
Yeah,
and then I guess around the time that we hooked up with Barsook, we got a booking agent as well, which was infinitely better. We started going out with bands, and we were support
right.
for that. And
so who did you go out with during that time? And that was still in support of that first record.
Yeah.
Okay.
The first record, I think one of the first tours that we did that was in conjunction with somebody was, I think, the M's from Chicago, mm-hmm. a really great band. It's hard to pinpoint exactly when they were, but like we did three or four tours with Dr. Dog.
They're amazing.
Yeah, they're great. And they're my favorite live band, hands down. And hilariously enough, it was a one-off kind of show, I think, maybe, that was the first one where we had a booking agent. They booked it in Dallas. And it was with Delta Spirit and Simon Dawes, which is Dawes's, like, have you heard Dawes?
Yeah.
It's Dawes's first band. It has Blake Mills. This guy's phenomenal guitar player. He is playing with Fiona Apple now, and actually opening up for her.
Is that how she does it? Because David did that same thing.
Really?
Yeah, he played with her and opened. That's how she does it.
Oh, really? Yeah,
she's
I'm
like,
sure.
Yeah, you can play guitar for me. You can open for me.
Right. That's awesome. Like, because yeah. I haven't seen Blake Mills live except for with Simon Dawes, and his album is absolutely incredible. So I'm really happy to. We went to that South by show this last March and saw him up on stage. Jason and I was like, hey, there's totally Blake Mills up there.
Yeah.
I mean, he's played with Band of Horses and Jenny Lewis and a bunch of other people too.
Yeah.
But yeah, one of the first shows that we had with a booking agent was in Dallas. It was a Club Dada, I think. and it was with Delta Spirit and Simon Dawes, which are two of my favorite bands.
Yeah.
So we did one. I don't know if this was for the first record, but we toured with Long Winters. I think that was for the
second one.
No, it wasn't for the second record.
That was What Doesn't Kill Us.
It was the end of the first record, and it was Long Winters and Manamana.
Manamana.
I never knew that. I guess I'd never seen that on Sesame Street. Oh. Like when people always sing that when I say it.
Yeah.
Yes. Let's see, who else was it? I don't know. There've been a ton of them. French Kicks. We did one tour with French Kicks, which was really great at the time. I really liked them a lot, and that was one of those milestones where I felt like, I think that was the first band that I really, really liked that we actually got on tour with, and that was really fun. So
that's good. So when you went to go do the second record, you had like label support, and you guys, were you writing throughout those tours and stuff, or?
It was not really. I mean, the whole.
You just have to come back and scramble and write, or you just had some shit left over and maybe you wrote a couple new songs or something?
We had a little. I mean, I was writing occasionally. I write kind of slow. It just comes in bursts, really, you know. And I haven't written a song a full out song since maybe November of last year. So it's just been.
Yeah, it happens.
But, you know, it. We'd occasionally write some stuff, and a lot of that second record is stuff that Jason and I just kind of hold up in my studio. I had the first record we recorded, like most of it was recorded out, and I had a house over there back behind Taco Express and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I had a pretty big room back there, and we recorded most of the first record in my studio back there. So we just kind of like hold up out there and you know, kind of demoed some stuff, and we started working with Chris, and that was great. That was the first time we really had like a pre-production kind of thing going on where we'd play the songs and
kind of
reconstruct it and move edit stuff around.
How did you handle that? Because a lot of times your first foray into that as an artist, like, fuck you, I'm fucking, like, you know what I mean? You
yeah.
Tell me, what do you know?
It was an adjustment, and it's still something.
But it pays off.
It does. Yeah, it's something I'm still adjusting to. Like I was on this last record, I was demoing most of the stuff over at Danny's. Danny has like his studio's in his house, but he has a room that the lemurs and everybody practice in. Back there, it's a very crowded room. It's a little tiny thing. I need wide open spaces.
Yeah,
I'm a Dixie chick. But the
I'm a Dixie chick.
A Dixie guy. But Dixie dude. But you know, I do stuff out there and then kind of run it, you know, by Mitch, who's a singer in the Lemurs, and Danny, and especially with Danny. Danny was a really busy guy, so it was always supremely frustrating when I'd take something to him and he hadn't had time to listen to it, yeah. And then he finally gets time to listen to it, and he's like, bah, 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 and I was like, bah.
Yeah.
Like, I've been out here working. I've been slaving over this. And there's some things that I can be stubborn that I'll stick to.
Well, there should be. I mean, there should be some. Like, you can't just do everything everyone tells you to do.
But, right.
Yeah.
But there are some. There definitely some songs like Rosewood and Swift Justice on this new record that rearranging those parts or shortening certain things and stuff like that, or even, you know, Just Run, the initial demo I did of that was like so slow, and it made it. I think we shaved off at least 30 or 45 seconds by upping
just by
it
speeding
by
it. Yeah.
Yeah, like 5 BPM or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of those things that I've definitely gotten a little more amenable to, but initially it was, and Sultan was probably the best example of that, because we did kind of rearrange that one to shit, like, and it was good because it was going to be the single. I had initially written that song. My friend worked at a Fox Supervision in LA, and he had this TV show that needed a theme song, and it was, the thing had one episode, it was the pilot episode, and got canceled. but it was called Drive, and it was about this all these people that they get like a letter in the mail or something like that, and they can they can get this money, but they can't tell anybody, but they have to drive whoever wins, like is races all the way across America or something like that,
yeah.
to get to this thing, would win the money, but they couldn't tell anybody. It was very secretive, and they all had these troubled lives and all that stuff. And he gave me the the animated sequence for the intro, opening scene, yeah. for the intro. So I kind of had a leg up on everybody else because I was sitting there writing it to this 45 right. second thing. And it was one of the coolest experiences I had. Like Jason and I, he would send me something. The first thing he sent us that, and we wrote this really heavy, as like Sound Hagar or Sammy Garden. Like it was like Soundgarden meets Sammy Hagar, and it was like the total 80s vocals with like back masking and all that stuff.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And really heavy guitar stuff. It was super like 91 or 90 probably even. And we sent that to them, and they're like, yeah, I don't know, that's a little aggressive and everything. And how about back to the drawing board? And this was all within like a week or something,
right,
like
that. Right, so that's go fast.
So then we went back and I did this more pensive kind of thing where they're all thinking about their lives, and it was and I listen to these things now, and they sound like theme songs, because if you can't like shove like a good song into 40 seconds, then it might not be a good song after all anyway.
Right.
So it's really cool, these little vignettes of like songs, and it was a really fun experience, and we'd get them done in like a day, and then just send it back to them, and then sit there with our fingers crossed. And so then send back the pensive one, and they're like, I don't know, that's a little plodding, and you know, like it doesn't move very well. So then I had this one little thing that I had written maybe just the beginning of for Sultan, and that turned out to be Sultan. So Sultan initially was just a theme song, a 40-second theme song for Drive, and I lost out to Gavin Rossdale. He was the one that got it. And then the show got canceled like one day after, and he got to buy another gold plate stroller or something like that, and I got to get $2,000 more in the hole.
Nice.
But yeah, we went in with that song, especially because it was only like 40 seconds, and then I write lyrics. I tend to write lyrics last. Mm-hmm. I'm really meticulous about it. I want it exactly to say exactly what I want. So I tend to do the vowel sound kind of thing
first, then
a lot of the words are built around the vowel sounds that I just meow out all the time.
Yeah.
And that one, I don't even think I finished the lyrics to like the bridges or something until the day we were recording vocals. But that was very much one of those ones that shifted around and shortened bridges and lengthened and drop out here and all this stuff. And it was because we were working with a producer, we were kind of forced to be okay with this stuff. So it was a good trial by fire kind of thing for us that has made me 10% better? At taking that kind of criticism.
That's good. That's really good. So so what did you guys do afterwards? You went back out on tour. This time, was it a little bit, did you feel like you had taken a step? Like, okay, we went back, we did this record with the producer, now we have like a record that, sometimes that perception when you're putting out records, you do one by yourself, then you do one like in a quote unquote real place. You know, oh yeah, this is the shit now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it was, that whole recording process was actually very tedious and stressful. I remember, just for one reason, it was it rained that whole summer, and we were recording it at Cacophony, which is right there on the river,
right.
or lake. And it was just, we had set up like 8 of our guitars, and it would just rain, and it was so humid, and the guitars would go out of tune like crazy. There were a few songs
we actually, humidity and stuff.
We actually had to punch out like in the middle of the song and retune the guitar to keep going.
Oh, horrible.
And we were, there were just some kind of interpersonal kind of tensions.
After you've been on the road for a year.
That too, and with people that, you know, you met at the inception of the group, you know, and it's just like, and you know, being on the road in general is just kind of stressful. You add to that, like, not knowing people that well and other people having other lives.
And you're living with them.
And then, you know, also at the time, I did kind of primarily write most of those songs on that second record. There are a few that we did collaboratively, and I think some of those are some of the better songs on that record for sure.
Was there any tension because of that you wrote them?
Kind of.
You started feeling like, oh, now if we get a TV show, Homeboy's going to make all the money and we're going to be
burgers. We were definitely, we're still pretty socialistic, is that a word?
No.
About our sharing of publishing. It wasn't, you know,
right.
Like the primary songwriter, we get
and then
more,
there's the non-writer share.
It was definitely more like that. But still, it was more just like creative outlet kind of thing. Because Drew, our keyboard player, was you know, he writes a lot of songs, and he has the exact opposite take on writing songs or method to writing songs that I do, which is like he. You know, he's a MIDI keyboard guy. He just throws all the instruments in there.
Yeah.
And then you have to kind of peel back the layers to get...
Where you start off with the acoustic guitar and then you build it completely.
I get the melody and just, you know, all the stuff that I feel is just necessary. And then add the bells and whistles last and stuff. And, you know, and he writes great songs. And he's, you know, he sings most of those. Or he sang all of the ones that he wrote in the band. So there was that kind of thing too, where one... person's one to pull one direction and you know
and then that person each I know this sounds weird, and you hear about it like with really famous people, even bands like the Bee Gees and stuff, where the people are brothers, where the people like your friends are like, oh dude, don't let that guy sing, man, you're the guy, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean,
and sometimes it happens to me in situations. I'm sure it does, like in this Skyrocket band, because there's fucking four people singing,
right.
And I know there's tons of people like, dude, you should sing all new, you know. No, I shouldn't. It's entertaining because there's four people coming up there.
Right. And that's what we, you know, I wanted that, you know, when I put those ads out there, what I wanted to do, which is just
like the Beatles,
naive as shit, but you just want, I mean, that's the cornerstone for everything. Like you want everything to sound like the Beatles, and it has so much variety because of that.
Yeah.
And I still wanted that, but at the same time, you know, I had all these other songs where a majority of those ones were moving in this direction, and you kind of want to keep it
a direction.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
Or keep it cohesive enough, you know? And it just kind of, you know, it was just really a stressful time to do that. And that's, you know, around the end of, or maybe midway or two thirds through the touring in 2008 is when, you know, we parted ways with Drew, and, which is, I think, you know, it was sad and all that stuff because he was there with us from the start, but I know that he's happier doing things his way because I'm so stubborn, and I have a certain way that I need it to happen and stuff. And but now he's got that outlet he's released an album called Trumpet or Swan, and he's got that outlet to do things, you know, his songs, and get them out there, and I'm really happy for him for that. But it was definitely a stressful time. That just the recording of that in particular, but I mean, the touring that came after was pretty.
And you go out and you have resentment and issues and shit, and then you stick everyone in a van and like go
right,
be poor.
Yeah, it's
have days filled with adversity together
silence.
And try and get along. Yeah.
But you know, I think that. We've kind of come out the other side of that with a better perspective, and you know, we're if something's being stifled, even, you know, songs that Drew wrote or something like that, if they're being stifled because they weren't going the direction that he had to, because they were anchored by these parameters that were laid down by the band in general,
right,
or me or whatever, then, you know, that music. It suffers, like the song suffers if it's not exactly, you know, what the vision of, you know, the visioneer.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you gotta, it's a fine line. I mean, there's a fine line between collaboration and letting a vision come through without you clouding it with your judgment and a lot of times self-motivated reasons, because if everyone was trying to make the best song, they'd probably just try and go in the same direction, it seems like. It seems like sometimes whenever you are going in the right direction, then you're doing the right thing. But when there's all this, you know,
right,
chaos, and you
might, and especially with us coming from different musical backgrounds, shoving that through the small hole of what it's the final product is going to be is such a, you know, that's such an arduous process and painful. It's kind of like birth. It's exactly like birth.
It is like birth.
Yeah.
It's not as physically as painful in your genitalia.
Right.
But it is painful.
Right.
Yeah. So with this record, the newest one, you can't fall off the floor. You are, do you feel like this is more of a focused, like, did you have, obviously, if it was going to be a solo album and it went back to being Milwaukee, you obviously had a vision for it and set out to do a certain thing with Danny.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, totally. After all the chaos that ensued after, you know, that 2008, and we got back from those tours, and both Jason and I got divorces, and we all had to go back to day jobs because we were just in financial shambles and all that stuff. So I started kind of, you know, maybe selfishly just writing just whatever came out of me. I was married for 8 years.
And that's good songs, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, no offense to Mrs. Michael, former Mrs. Michael, but I got divorced too. Awesome songs.
Yeah, that's, I mean, this is...
Like,
this
fuck, is, you're like, wow, this is my like blood a whole on the tracks. New world.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was, you know, I had to kind of just get all this stuff out of me because because I like so many different types of music, I've always prided us, or this band, on being somebody who doesn't sound the same way all the time. You know? And our records really reflect that, and we've caught a lot of flack from it too, because, you know, they always, our Pitchfork called us like the kitchen sink. I mean, both of our records were kitchen sink to them, just like throw a bunch of stuff in there, and that's what I want. I mean, I love Interpol.
The White Album or something.
Right, yeah. I love Interpol, but I don't want every single song that we play, hey, well, that's obviously them, you know, I wanted us to sound... I like country music. I like rap music. I like jazz music. I love the 60s, oldies, 50s, you know, all that stuff. I mean, and I always, you know, as I hate to call myself an artist, I'd like to, but you know, I'm working towards it. But like, as you know, a songwriter and stuff, I want to dip my toe in all those waters and see what happens. And I don't necessarily, you know, maybe I'll stay there someday when I get to the, when I feel like settling down and just staying in one place, maybe I'll just write an album that just sounds like all country or all rock and roll or whatever. But like, while there's all this stuff happening right now, I just want to feed off those kind of musical innovations and inspirations, like to do my take on it, you know, or what inspires me about it, and kind of just spit it back out the way I'd like to. And, so, you know, I went, after all that stuff in 2008, I just needed to get out of Austin and move down to Conroe, and lived with Kelly Doyle, who's playing guitar with us now. He plays with Robert Ellis as well. And Jason Davis. We lived in a double-wide trailer on like 2 acres of land with goats.
It's awesome.
And the living room was just studio. Or the living room, well, the living room was a living room, but the... there were two living rooms, and then the other one was had the drums and everything and all the instruments, and then the dining room was the control room and stuff. So I just wake up, didn't have a job or anything, and just go over there, listen to an album in the morning,
having coffee, and then go write a song,
just write songs and record them all day. So, and a lot of that stuff was very, there's a lot of electronica-ish sounding stuff. Mm-hmm. More like Portishead meets Queens of the Stone Age, which will probably end up being the next Milwaukee record, if that comes to fruition. But yeah. That, you know, there was a lot of that stuff there. But I mean, I wrote like 30 songs in like 3 months. It was the most. Probably it was the most time. I've ever like gotten out of me.
It's like purging.
Yeah, it was amazing, and I mean, like this huge cathartic experience where I never had the time. When you're going on tour and you have to go back to the day job and stuff like that, you never have the time to write. And I can't write on the road very well either. Yeah, it's just strange. I can write lyrics, I guess, on the road, so yeah, I just wrote all these songs and you know, a lot of them will probably be on future releases and some of them might not be on anything, but they, you know, I gravitated towards a few of them and kind of sorted those out. And, you know, it is kind of unfortunate. I would love to make a Dark Side of the Moon kind of record that has this whole cohesive thing where it's like a quilt of all the same ideas that very much mesh together naturally. Right. And this record, I still think it's still all over the map, and I'm sure I'm going to take some more flack for it, but I really don't give a shit. We have like a prog Sinatra song on here. We have like one that sounds exactly like something off In Utero, and we have a country song on there, which is kind of Willie meets George Jones. And it's just still all over the place. But I think that the common thread underneath it all is the lyrical content and stuff like that. I think that it's very much about, you know, it's not all about
a lot of times it's about the destruction of life, your life, and like reconstructing your life, like going back to a completely clean slate with just a shitload more issues.
Right. And viewing that as it falls apart and as it's laying on the floor and putting it back together and just kind of, and you know, just your take and your
this is your time as the Phoenix.
Jesus, I hope so.
No, seriously, I mean, it could be. I've only heard the one song, which brings us back to the Kickstarter thing you guys can find. It's Kickstarter/...
It's not. No? That's a weird thing about Kickstarter. They don't have that. It's like /0016247.
But they can just go to whatmademilwaukeefamous.com. That's where I found it.
Yeah, or just go to Kickstarter and search What Made Milwaukee Famous, and it'll come up. It's the only thing.
And you guys have some nice gifts. You're going to go make someone dinner if they give you a lot of money, right?
Yeah, I think that's like the $1,000 package. We'll make you dinner and hang out all night. And plus you get all the...
you all can't night. Get rid of us. We'll stay at your house for a week.
We'll bring sleeping bags. You provide the sleeping bags. But you get everything in the packages below that. And generally, that's the rule with the packages. But some of them are a little different.
Are you a good cook or something?
I'm awful.
Don't say that on here.
Yeah, I'm not gonna. Well, I'm not cooking for him. I'll make the shells and cheese. I'll pour the wine. How about that? John and Jason are both really good cooks.
Okay, good. So. All right. So you guys have some shows coming up with May 11th, which is this Saturday or no Friday? Friday, May 11th at Hotel Vegas. You're doing a special show. Like an evening with you guys are doing two different sets of completely different songs.
Yeah, totally. It's pretty much, I don't know. It's not necessarily old set than new set or anything like that. We're going to mix them together, but, we're going to play a fair share of songs off the new album and some we're going to play a song that we haven't played in like 4 years.
So, that's cool. Yeah. You guys do covers?
Yeah.
What do you do? I mean, you've got that with, the Mods.
I'll give you this hint. The cover we're doing, the band's name is an acronym.
Okay.
And the song is awesome.
Okay. The band is an acronym.
Yeah, our band's kind
of an acronym.
Is it
Fuck the Police by NWA?
FTP, no. NWA, no.
That would be Noir.
but tis around that era, I believe.
Good.
And it's not rap.
Okay. Okay, so you guys have other shows. You're going to do the Free Press Summerfest in Houston on June 2nd. Mm-hmm. And then on June 8th, you're at Trees in Dallas.
Right, yeah.
Still rocking up there at Trees. They closed down for a little while.
Right.
Came back.
It's really rocking. I think they have a lot of metal-ish bands, so we're kind of...
Are you like a closet metal guy?
I liked Iron Maiden for like 4 weeks and when I was nine. I do like metal. I have like maybe Rain of Blood. I don't have a lot of metal records, but I'm absolutely
open. Not against it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I like hard stuff. I don't really... I love Judas Priest. I love Judas Priest.
You like good songs, though. Me too.
I just like
Judas
songs.
Priest,
yeah.
You know. So, is there anything that we haven't covered about you? I mean, I'm sure there isn't. There is, but in this fashion, in this podcast way.
No, that's pretty much it. We just wrote my biography today.
Yeah. Yeah, you can just hand people a copy of this MP3. Hey,
right.
You have an hour to sit down and listen to me.
It's my Obama
and Johnny.
Book.
So people should come out to Hotel Vegas here, and it's a chance to go see the band. And you have a lot of guests on the record, I saw. That's exciting.
Yeah, but we have Kathleen Edwards. She sang sang kind of a duet on one song called Rosewood. And we have Matt Vasquez from Delta Spirit sings back up, and Dana Falconberry, and
Gary Newcomb, who I love.
Gary Newcomb, yeah, plays pedal steel, and Dave Polkingham from Alejandro's.
Love Dave Polkingham.
Plays a solo in one song too. So
nice. Well, man, I wish you a lot of luck, and we'll play the new song that you're doing, "Gone and Done It Now." Sounded so square. Like a 50s, like, we're going to go and play the rock and roll song by the rock band from Austin, Texas. What made Milwaukee famous? Gone and Done It Now. So, we'll play those songs. But thank you so much, Michael, for coming over.
Thanks for having me.
And everyone go see them. Go to whatmademilwaukeefamous.com and give them some money so they can make a video for you to enjoy.
Thanks.
All right. Have a good day. All right, so that was my guest, Michael Kincaid. Always good to talk to him. They're great. I hope you guys go out to that show at Hotel Vegas this Friday, May 11th. What made Milwaukee famous? All right, everyone, thank you so much for listening. Remember, what should you remember? Subscribe on iTunes. Like us on Facebook. Just get involved with this podcast. I want you to get involved. I want you to criticize me. You can insult me. I don't give a shit what you do. Just, you know. Give me some attention. Here's a brand new song by What Made Milwaukee Famous, "Gone and Done It Now." Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye. Did you ever consider that you yourself would be the beast? Is it the one you were buying?